welcome to the episode you've all been waiting for. Yes, this is the one where we answer your questions. Get ready to hear about tongue ties, inductions, and all those things you asked us in this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favorite podcast host. Welcome to this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron, and I am joined today with the wonderful Rachel Reed, and we put out to you guys to send us your questions, and my goodness, did you. So we have got a selection of questions that we are going to go through today, and hopefully we will get to answer some of your burning questions, thoughts, ideas, and give you some more discussion points. So enjoy this episode.
But first, here's a disclaimer. So Katie and I cannot give individual advice or recommendations. As registered midwives, we're accountable for any information we share, and we cannot give recommendations to anybody who is not our client or we're not caring for. It would breach ethical and legal standards. So that's a little disclaimer. So what we're going to do is, most of the questions were general anyway. There was a couple that were a bit more personal, but we will just answer them in general terms.
Wonderful. Thank you for clarifying the statement from us before we start. So who's going to start?
This is all opinions, not medical advice, but opinions.
It is just our opinions based on some research, but not specific to you. That you must seek help from your own care provider. So on that point, let's get going. Rachel?
Are you going to go first?
May I ask you a question, Rachel?
No, you've got a question first.
Oh, I've got a question first. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller. Please tell me your question.
All right, because I like this one. So is tongue tie really on the rise? What do you think about this, Katie?
When I saw this question, that is my response. And the reason it's my response, I must say, I have been out of the tongue tie bubble for 2 years now. And it's been quite pleasing, because living in Australia and also being in contact with a lot of people in the UK who are midwives and lactation consultants, it just feels like it is everywhere. And it's completely talked about obsessively almost on social media. And it feels like every problem with breastfeeding seems to be related to a tongue tie, whether that's a tongue tie, a lip tie. We're now hearing about cheek ties. But actually what we see when we look at the research, and I've just had a quick update as well, just to refresh myself, and there's some really interesting stuff out there. We're still seeing that the research reports anywhere between about 3 to 11% of infants are being diagnosed with a tongue tie. And we also see in some of the research that really less than 50% of babies are reported to have breastfeeding difficulties if they are shown to have a tongue tie, or they're identified with a tongue tie. But of course, with these research reports, the amount is actually highly variable, because there's some studies that report universal difficulties, whilst there's others reporting very few difficulties from a tongue tie. So they're instead noting that incorrect positioning and attachment to the breast was the main cause of breastfeeding problems. And we see this when we look at the literature with sore nipples. This is the main reason for why infants have sore nipples. And obviously that makes sense. I mean, when we look at the first week.
Babies don't have sore nipples.
Sorry. Mums have sore nipples. Let me clarify. I hope babies don't have sore nipples. There's a whole nother podcast. We do see swollen breast tissue, and sometimes we see milk released from infants and known as witch's milk. It's such a, yay, in one way, a wonderful, but also a horrible term. And that happens on both boys and girls. It is those remaining hormones through the infant, and it will pass. So that's quite normal to see that breast tissue enlargement on infants.
Stop trying to avoid tongue tie.
So basically, there was a Cochrane review done in 2017, but really it could only report on 5 prior randomized controlled trials. And in that, there was a total of 302 infants. But what they state were these studies are small and underpowered, and they all include very short-term outcomes or subjective outcomes. And they suggest further robust studies are carried out. And this is the point. For me, there is not enough evidence out there for what is occurring at this point. And maybe that comes in the future. And I really hope it does. And there is a trial happening in the UK, which is going to be the biggest trial, randomized controlled trial, that is done on looking at whether infants should or shouldn't have a frenotomy, which is the operation to snip and cut the lingual frenulum, so the piece of membrane underneath the tongue. So the FROSTIE trial is what it's called, and it's spelled FROSTIE, and I will make a link to it in the show notes. But they are going to conduct a randomized control trial with 870 infants. Those infants are randomized into either having a frenotomy with good breastfeeding support or no surgery with the same amount of breastfeeding support. Currently, at this point, they've recruited 141 infants, and their primary outcome is to look at the rates of any breastfeeding at 3 months. Their secondary outcomes are extensive, and that includes things like breastfeeding pain using the short form McGill pain score. They're going to be looking at maternal self-efficacy and quite a long list of secondary outcomes, which are really interesting. So I would highly recommend you go and have a look at their study proposal and what's going on.
And that's interesting, because, and the thing is, so it's randomized controlled trial, but women are going to know, obviously, whether their babies have had the treatment or not had the treatment. But I guess if they're looking at self-efficacy and other measures, they might actually pick some of that stuff up, how the women feel about the feeding.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. Yeah. So I read through the trial protocol and had a look, because I was drawn to this from another piece, another article that's just been released that was a bit of a summary article. And it spoke about them, and they actually mentioned that they were going to be doing a sham operation for those randomized into the no surgery. But I cannot find that in the trial protocol. So, and that would be quite easy. If you're using scissors, it would be quite easy potentially to do a sham operation. If you've got a very, I'm going to put inverted quotes, anterior tongue tie that is really obvious and to the tip of the tongue, it would be quite obvious for a mum to see that that hadn't been snipped. So it's a difficult one, absolutely. But I think, yes, the fact that their secondary outcomes are looking at quite a multitude of factors is good. But again, when we look at some of the smaller trials, you know, some of them have already shown that just good breastfeeding support can help quite a lot of women. It really brings us back to the fact that we know so little about the frenulum, the lingual frenulum. And there has been a new study just from last year by Dr. Nikki Mills and Professor Donna Geddes. Dr. Nikki Mills is a pediatric ENT consultant from New Zealand. She's done a lot of work looking into tongue tie. And Professor Donna Geddes is the director of the Human Lactation Research Group at the University of Western Australia. Among other things that Donna researches, she looks quite intensely at tongue tie. And their new paper, or fairly new paper from last year, basically they have been looking at the surgical release of the lingual frenulum, so known as a frenotomy, and they state that it has become an increasingly common procedure performed from birth through to adulthood. But surprisingly, they say, detailed anatomy of the in situ lingual frenulum has never been described, and no anatomical basis has been proposed for the individual variability in frenulum morphology. The lingual frenulum is frequently referred to as a cord or submucosal band of connective tissue, yet there is no evidence to support this anatomical construct. So their paper aims to describe the anatomy of in situ lingual frenulum and its relationship to the floor of the mouth structures. And what they have done is they've actually taken, I think it was 8 cadavers, and they have looked specifically at the lingual frenulum and the makeup of this. And it's a really interesting but quite gruesome, because there is a lot of pictures, paper. I will link to that in the show notes as well. And this is quite fascinating. What we're seeing is, you know, there's tongue tie conferences, there's a huge amount of tongue tie release that's being done, both through simple form in terms of with scissors and practitioners, whether that's a lactation consultant, a midwife, or a pediatrician. But we're also now seeing laser treatment. And this is the issue, is we're seeing anterior tongue ties, posterior tongue ties, labial frenulums, lip ties, that's what I'm trying to say. And we don't yet have the evidence to say yay or nay. And this is my problem with it, is are we jumping to conclusions? We see something and it's a bit like, what's that thing when you see the horses, but there's a zebra? So we're going for what we think is, don't you know that? It's like you miss.
That's when you've been taking drugs, Katie.
So basically, look for the zebra through the horses. It's don't just look what's in front of you. That baby may have a tongue tie, but how is she holding that baby? What's going on psychologically for that mother? I mean, for years, I've always been saying, you know, and I point to my head, and I think I probably said this on the podcast before, this before this. So I point to the head, the mother's psychological well-being, her mental health, how she feels, how she approaches breastfeeding before what's going on with the breast, because they link together, just like in birth. So if we're seeing a tongue tie and we're identifying this and we're going, oh my goodness, we need to sort this tongue tie out, what does that place in her brain? Does she then think that changes in positioning and attachment, or how she holds the baby, or the support she gets, is going to make a difference? And this is what worries me, is that we are jumping to these conclusions and maybe not putting the right support in the right place. A baby who has a tongue tie may well need it released. Absolutely. And I have seen that in my practice. I am actually qualified to release tongue ties from a previous hospital. So I am not against it. But what I am against is that we do this in the first 24 hours, that we're jumping to conclusions, that we're, you know, this hype that is around it. And I think anything that has this big hype causes, I'm also seeing quite a lot of anger online. And I think our breastfeeding skills and our breastfeeding support needs to be bloody good, to be honest, to be able to support these women. They might be needing to be seen or spoken to every day just to get through because their baby may be having more difficulties than someone else. So for me, the jury's out. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing phrenotomies, but it does mean that we need to be just taking a step back and really thinking about the whole picture. Look at that baby. What's that baby's anatomy like? Not just in its tongue, but its facial structure. You know, is it a bit squished from kappa or molding? Like, is its face a bit asymmetrical and it can't actually attach to the breast and that's why it's falling on and off of the breast all the time? There's lots of things we need to take into account. So for me, it's, yeah, I think just let's just pull back from this hype and actually realize that often some of those real basics work and they've been working for a long time.
So basically, tongue tie is not necessarily on the rise, but identification and management of tongue tie is on the rise, which may or may not be a good thing.
Absolutely. And I think there's more awareness. So then there's more identification. There's more places that are offering laser treatment through dentists and other surgeons with that ability. Mums are talking about it much more. It's constantly talked about on social media, in mums groups. And then therefore that seems to be the panacea of this is the cure-all for sore nipples and breastfeeding problems and attachment.
And also that there will be a problem. I breastfed a baby with a tongue tie and luckily had no idea that she had a tongue tie until a long time afterwards. And that might have changed how I approached breastfeeding if I thought that we might have problems.
Yep, exactly. So again, it's about planting that seed of doubt. We need to be careful in our language and we need to be careful. But the problem is, you know, I've seen in practice that I've had, you know, new mums come into me and they've read a huge amount online and they've come in with their partner and they've literally come into my clinic where we always would do a full assessment of a feed, get a full history, and then make a decision with the parents on whether we thought a phrenotomy should be performed or not. And I've had many parents come in and they're angry before they even sit down. And I've had parents shouting at me when I said, I don't think this baby needs a phrenotomy. I don't want to put scissors in a baby's mouth unless I feel confident that that is happening. I also want to give it a bit of time. I also have to balance the fact that some women are absolutely desperate and their nipples are incredibly painful. So it is a highly difficult emotional time and it's complex, but I think we shouldn't be judging to conclusions. It is not that we can see on the rise, and really we need to wait for this big trial to give us some good evidence. Right, Rachel, I've done my phrenotomy and tongue tie question. I hope I have satisfied the listeners' answers to that, and I will make the links. I am going to ask you probably one of your favorite questions.
Let me guess, induction of labor. Woohoo!
You are on the money. It is induction of labor. So the question is, at the hospital where I work, they recommend induction of labor for advanced maternal age and ethnicity, stating that these individuals have risk factors at 40 weeks. What is the evidence around this? And I really wish you'd spoken about this in your induction book, maybe in the second edition.
Awesome. So the book was a limited word count, which I actually think I might have gone over. So there were some things that couldn't go in there. So I didn't pick on things like ethnicity because it's actually really shouldn't be a thing. But anyway, we'll get to that. So I guess we need to start with the whole threshold for risk. So there is individual risk factors for every, all of us have a risk. Every woman who's pregnant risks stillbirth because that is, you know, life. That is nature, is pathology. And we are in a culture, in kind of the Western birth culture world, that we do not tolerate particular risks and we're willing to take other risks. So you always kind of do this. There's no safe way to have a baby. There's just different risks and you kind of pick your way through the risks. And our maternity system is set up very much focusing on the huge, catastrophic, but rare risk versus the pretty likely risk associated with the intervention to stop the catastrophic risk. And I guess, you know, we're seeing that play out big scale in terms of coronavirus, and pretty much globally, the response has been that we are going to do this big response that will have lots of significant risks that we're not necessarily measuring or factoring in terms of mental health, economics, and how domestic violence, addiction, all these other things that are going on because of the lockdown. But what is more important is this less than 1%, you know, less than 0.5% risk of death, because we're terrified of death in our climate. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that is what we look at risk through, is that lens of anything to prevent a death. So that's how we have these induction recommendations that are absolutely focused on the horrific risk of stillbirth, because it's catastrophic if it happens. So that's the key risk. And all the other things that might happen by us trying to not have that risk don't matter so much. So when we're looking at, and women can make that decision for themselves, and this is part of making decisions about induction, because they're offered to pretty much everyone, is you need to look at what are the risks in my situation and what's meaningful to me. Because for one woman, a 0.whatever% chance of stillbirth is much more meaningful to her than a much, you know, much more increased chance that she'll have a cesarean, or that she'll, you know, have longer term health outcome implications from the interventions. So that being said, I do say so a lot. I did notice that listening to my perineal thing. So. So. So we need, that's a threshold of risk. So if we're looking at risk then, and I could, you know, have actually written a book on the risks of induction. There are lots of risks associated with induction, and a lot of those risks are very specific to the individual situation. There's different risks for women who have previously had babies versus women who are having their first baby. And advanced maternal age has become a reason to offer induction, and that's kind of fairly standard. And again, so this is not like post-dates pregnancy, where we've got randomized controlled trials that have actually randomized women to be induced and not be induced, and then looked at whether induction reduces the stillbirth rate, which it does. Still, we're always talking about less than 1% when we're talking about, 0.0% and up. That's the kind of numbers we're talking about. So when we look at other reasons for induction, we don't have those randomized controlled trials. Instead, what people have done is look retrospectively at data. Mm-hmm. And then looked at stillbirth rates for certain gestations amongst certain populations, and then said, okay, well, for this group of women, the stillbirth rate is higher. Therefore, we think that if we induce, it'll reduce the chance of stillbirth. So when we're looking at the population of advanced maternal age, which is anyone over 35, so that's actually like most women having babies nowadays.
Yep.
Then if you compare their risk of stillbirth according to gestational age, then they do have an increased chance of stillbirth compared to, say, a 20-year-old. But it's still less than, it's 0., you know, I wrote about this in my book, so I can tell you some stats, even though stats are a bit pointless, really, because it's the emotion, not the stat, that alters mm-hmm. the way people feel. So, for example, you know, women over 40 years old have a 0.2% chance of stillbirth between 39 and 40 weeks, compared to a 0.1% chance for a woman who's under 35 years old. So it's kind of stratified according to age and gestation. But even, like, let's take the most extreme scenario. So, well, it's not the most extreme, because women can have babies up to 50 nowadays. So a woman who is over 40 years old and she is 42 weeks pregnant, she has a 1% chance of stillbirth. Mm-hmm. So these are the numbers we're talking about. So the reason that induction is offered is because of that statistical increase. However, The research that has looked at whether or not inducing reduces the chance of stillbirth for that group of women, it doesn't significantly. Right. And what it does do is it increases their chance of having other interventions.
Mm-hmm.
So induction reduced the perinatal death rate from 0.26% to 0.08%. So that's statistically significant, I guess. And the research has concluded that perinatal death is rare, and even for women aged 35 and over, that 562 inductions would need to be carried out at 40 weeks to prevent one death. The study also found that induction before 41 weeks was associated with a 20 to 30% increased rate of emergency cesarean and 10% increased rate of instrumental birth.
Yeah.
And women and babies were also more likely to be readmitted to hospital within 28 days of the birth after induction. So there was obviously some other risk factors that women would need to consider. And, you know, if you're going to have another baby after having a cesarean, having a scar on your uterus increases your chance of stillbirth to a higher rate than those statistics that I just said there. I think it's 0.4% without looking. So it's interesting that, you know, that isn't factored into it. So in terms of ethnicity, they're doing the same thing. They're looking at populations and going, okay, so for this population in general, there is increased statistical risk. And it's retrospective data. And the studies are quite old data as well. They're actually, the studies are written kind of nowish, but the data is often like in the early 2000s. So, you know, there might be other things going on that have changed, or we don't know. It's not really a contemporary contemporary look at what's happening now. And what that research has found looking backwards is that perinatal mortality risk increases after 39 weeks for South Asian, African and Mediterranean women compared to European whites. So this research was, I think it was done in Norway or somewhere in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It was still less than 1%. So We're still talking about less than 0.0%. So the numbers even were reported in numbers out of 10,000 or numbers out of 1,000 because the rates were so small.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that women from ethnic minorities have worse outcomes, particularly in settings where, you know, then they're a minority.
And absolutely.
We
see that with so many things.
Exactly. And it's interesting because Queensland Health Guidelines, when they look at, you know, they're looking at their reasons for induction and block in their induction guidelines, actually say that they do not recommend induction of labour based on ethnicity. And this is a quote from them. Differences in ethnicity have been reported in perinatal mortality data, but whether this is entirely attributable to genetic factors is unclear. Insufficient evidence to recommend induction of labour based on maternal ethnicity alone. Consider a woman's ethnicity in the context of other risk factors when determining timing of induction of labour. So I don't know where the questioner works, but there isn't really evidence for offering induction based around ethnicity. There is, you know, some evidence for offering it to women based on age, but it needs to be given, you know, informed consent, as in information, in order to get consent. And yeah, so I would be questioning why ethnicity is even being brought up in terms of a reason for induction.
Yeah.
And it's even interesting to look closer at the guidelines sometimes. You hear hospitals kind of talking about their health, their hospital directives, or this is what we do in this hospital. And then you go, hang on, you're a state hospital. You're publicly funded. You should be following state guidelines.
Absolutely.
And what you're doing goes against even the state guidelines. So, you know, at the very least, I would hope that hospitals were following their own state guidelines, even if they're not following what I would like them to be doing, which is my opinion-based guidelines.
You're knowledgeable opinion-based. You wrote the book, Rachel. Come on.
The correct way to do it.
My way is this. Follow everything I say. No, don't. Listeners, don't. I mean, do, but don't.
Make up your own mind. Take responsibility for yourself. There you go.
Aye, man. Well, thank you for your favourite question, Lake. That were brilliant.
I'm sure that won't be the last induction one.
I think there might be another one to come.
Awesome.
Which one are you asking me?
I'm asking you my dream. I have a dream. I don't know a song that I've just made that song up. There isn't actually a song about I Had a Dream,
something,
is there?
There is, yeah. It's from that musical. It's that Jack Human in it.
Jack Human.
Yeah, Jack Human. Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman. I mean, who wants to be called Hugh? Oh, sorry, man. Sorry to all the Hughes. Hugh's a nice name. But Jack, I like the name Jack. Oh, I love Jack Human.
Right. Oh, God. Right. Quickly moving on. Shush.
I Had a Dream.
Are you ready?
What is that from? Go on, sing it. It's French. Les Miserables. Les Miserables. Les Miserables.
Oh, I don't watch that. Right. Shush. Stop avoiding the question. Here we go. You're going to have to cut that out because we're going to look like idiots.
No way. Keeping it.
My dream is to become an IBCLC. Lactation consultant, I'm guessing. I'm halfway through my midwifery course and hoping to get my hours with breastfeeding women whilst on the ward. I think it's 1,000 hours before I can sit the exam, question mark. I'll be bloody 50 by the time I become one. What is the most challenging part of your work, Katie, and the most rewarding?
Okay, yes. IBCLC stands for International Board Certified Lactation Consultant. It is an LC. Oh, it is 1,000 hours. So IBCLE, so the International Board Certified International Board Lactation Consultants Examiners, their requirements are a minimum of 1,000 hours of lactation-specific clinical practice that was obtained.
So how do you get that?
Well, if you wait, I'm telling you a story.
Right, right.
Gosh, okay. You've got to obtain it within the 5 years prior to sitting the exam. And so you obtain it by working as a midwife. So there are specific routes you can take. So if you are a midwife, you will go through one route. If you're a breastfeeding counsellor, you'll go through another route. If you're maybe a speech therapist and you want to do it, there's a different number of hours. If you're a GP, there's a different number of hours that you need to gain. But if you're a midwife, it's 1,000 hours. And it's really easy to get that. If you're on the postnatal ward, what percentage of your work is helping breastfeeding women? At least 50% of your day. If you're in the birthing suite, and there used to be guidelines, but actually I've re-looked and there isn't specific guidelines because we used to have to break it down and work out how you get these hours. And it used to say, I'm sure it was 25% or 20% of your work would be breastfeeding on antenatal or the birth suite. So you can count that as your hours. Obviously, if you're doing a breastfeeding clinic, then you can add that up. But really, if you're a midwife in the clinical setting, so you're doing some community, you're doing a bit of postnatal, you're doing a bit of birth, you're doing a bit of antenatal, probably 50% of your time is spent talking about breastfeeding. You might be doing breastfeeding in your antenatal classes. Well, if you're doing antenatal classes, I hope you're talking about breastfeeding. And if you look at rough numbers, if you only work 25 hours a week for 48 weeks of the year, so 4 weeks holiday, you're going to get over 1,000 hours within 2 years. So the point of having that many hours is that you don't go straight from being a newly qualified midwife and then, Bob's your uncle, I'm going to sit my lactation exam, but actually I've got no clinical experience. And this has actually been one of my bugbears about the IBCLC exam has been, there's no specific requirements that you have to work with a lactation consultant. You just have to prove that you've had these hours. Now, being the pessimistic side of me says, well, I could have just been a midwife who's actually been given poor breastfeeding information as a student. I'm learning from perhaps midwives that surround me who are doing the grab the baby's head and stick it on the breast jobby, which clearly, that's a whole nother podcast, does not float my boat. You're not actually seeing or learning from lactation consultants. You're not learning from midwives who have a gentle approach. You have any knowledge about breastfeeding, but you can sign off. Huh, I've done 1,000 hours because I've been working this amount anyway. For me, there needs to be, if you're going to be a practitioner and an expert, it's like learning midwifery only from a book. and then just sort of being in the delivery suite, but not doing it or not learning necessarily from someone, a more knowledgeable other. And I have a bit of a problem with this. I really feel that a lactation consultant, when you have those, it's not necessarily the number of hours. It's the quality, not the quantity. And so to have had an intensive, maybe 6 weeks working with a, you know, an expert in their field of lactation is probably going to teach you much more than just randomly working on the ward and, you know, trying to catch up with everything as a newly qualified midwife, for example. So, yeah, that's a bugbear of mine. That's where I get my ranty pants on, because I feel like you cannot learn how to be a lactation consultant just by reading books. Becoming a lactation consultant, definitely, you know, it's fascinating. I was a bit snobby back 15 years ago, nearly now, when I, just before I started the lactation consultant exam, I was in the UK and everyone was like, what's that? What is it? And I was running a breastfeeding clinic with a colleague, and I thought we were both going to do it together. And I thought, oh, this will be easy. I know most of this. Oh my goodness me, were my eyes opened. So there you go. That's my honesty. So I think, Rachel, the most challenging aspect for me of being an IBCLC over the years has been really to see that we're not using the evidence in our hospital systems to really support women who've had complex births or who are within an antenatal risk factor, or they're in a postnatal risk factor group. So there are women we can identify that are going to need more lactation support even before they've given birth. And yet our system is really set up to give good support most of the time to women with healthy term infants. And I just feel that we have so much knowledge and really about the absolute importance of those early hours and early days in terms of switching on the milk making cells and increasing that circulating prolactin. Now, if we've got a healthy term baby and a physiological birth, this baby's going to want to feed, you know, incredibly regularly and not necessarily scheduled, and will do this naturally. It's going to feed 10 to 15 times a day and just switch everything on, and this mother's going to end up with a normal and good milk supply. Yet we've had evidence for at least 10, 15 years showing how women with late preterm infants or babies who are separated, or, you know, if they're sleepy and they're not feeding well, we actually need to do some intervention. We need to support this mother correctly. And I think we have this huge fear about using pumps, using hand expression, putting too much pressure on women. And I just feel like we're putting women under huge amounts of pressure with how we medicalize birth. We've talked about this before. When there are risk factors with the mother or the infant, when there are risk factors because of the birth, we need to get in there early. And this can actually save a mother's milk supply. And what makes me really sad and is a real challenge is seeing these women at 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks down the track, and it's too late for me to do anything. And it's because we should have stepped in earlier. And that is not the mother's fault. That's the system. And our system is incredibly busy and incredibly complex, but we have a huge percentage of women who have or come along with potential risk factors that they're not going to make milk. And we know from the statistics that the biggest reason for that huge drop-off of breastfeeding rates in the first month is due to perceived or low milk supply. That's one of the major reasons. The other is sore nipples. Sore nipples go hand in hand with often low milk supply. You've got a baby who is not attached well, therefore they cause damage to the nipple. They don't drain the milk out, therefore the body doesn't get the right stimulation. So it sort of goes hand in hand. And I think that's my biggest challenge, is just trying to change this knowledge, making sure that, you know, as midwives, when, or as neonatal nurses, when such and such has happened, or this mother comes on and she's had an emergency cesarean section, an induction of labor, she's a risk factor. She's also diabetic and her BMI is over 30, plus she's over 35 and a first-time mother. She's a risk factor. She needs more support. And I don't know how we tackle that because it's not always easy to say, snap your fingers and there's more support in the postnatal ward. So, yes, that's my biggest challenge and also one of my biggest sadnesses that we have the potential to make these women have a successful breastfeeding career, you know what I mean? But we're just not implementing the research or the policies or the guidelines correctly, or we're not making it possible for midwives or nurses to do that in terms of time constraints. I'm sorry, I'm going to cheat here a little bit. And I've been asked what's my most rewarding part of being a lactation consultant. I need to say two things. Firstly, it's literally what the milk is. It fascinates me and it should fascinate all of us. The fact is that we don't even fully understand yet what is in the milk itself, what it's made up of, the components of milk. I heard this fantastic quote and I wish I could remember the person who said it because I've been using it for years now since I heard it because it's marvelous. And she said, "We have mapped the human genome, but we still don't know exactly what is in mother's milk." I just think that's incredible. And it just shows the lack of interest, the lack of funding. It's really one of the most under-researched areas. And the thing is, milk is way more than just nutrition. And that's why I get excited by it. Also, there's new research all the time coming out. So this just, you're always having your eyes opened. Bruce German is a human milk researcher. And he says the mother's body literally digests herself to make the milk for her infant. Just let that resonate for a minute. And if this wasn't important to our human babies, evolution would have got rid of this function. If we think about it, our human bodies use 23% of our energy just to run our brain. But when a mother's lactating, the breasts are using 25% of the energy. So making milk is energetically expensive. So it just tells us how vital this is. And milk's not just made up of protein and fats and lipids. It's also got things like human milk oligosaccharides. And they are the third most common component. And we're only just on the precipice of learning about these. We know that there's more than 100 of them. We know that they're expressed differently in different women, depending on where you live, what you eat, the time of day. But we also know that these human milk oligosaccharides actually survive in the baby's gut. And they are designed not necessarily for the baby, but they're the prebiotics. They're the food for the good bacteria in the baby's gut, which is just mind-blowing. They also do some other really awesome, awesome things. And I would highly recommend listening to Lars Bode. The other thing is that breast milk or human milk is full of bioactive components. It's there to fight off bacteria and viruses. It's even personalized medicine. It's different in each woman and it can change depending on what her infant needs or her environment. The other thing is it's alive. It's a living tissue and that's how we should be seeing breast milk. It's full of immune cells, stem cells, and it's got its own microbiome, these different types of bacteria that are going into the baby to seed its gut. It's constantly changing. And we also know those fats are absolutely essential for brain growth, both the grey and the white matter. So that's my first part of the question. And this is something which I just absolutely love to talk about and learn about. Okay, Rachel, so the other most rewarding aspect of being a lactation consultant is
really those times when mums have come in with struggling with whatever breastfeeding problem it is, and we've talked through what I recommend, advice, and what they could try, and they try it and it works. And then this mum suddenly just relaxes her shoulder and takes this big breath out and looks at her baby. And then looks up at me and she starts crying because it's the first time that she's had a feed where it doesn't hurt, for example, or she's just like, you can almost see her go, I'm being a mum. And she may have had a week of feeling not or disconnected from her baby, because all it is this awful dread of feeding every hour and a half, and they're in such an emotional state. And, you know, they've had this picture maybe put through to them that they're going to give birth and it's going to be physiological, and maybe that hasn't happened, and they've got trauma from the birth. And then of course the baby doesn't attach and things don't go to plan, and just the deep sadness and the guilt and the worry and the fear, and to see that sort of drain out of her, and her look at me, I'm getting emotional talking about it, is the most wonderful thing. I have such beautiful memories. And she'll say, we're feeding. I'm feeding my baby. And it's like, that's the greatest thing. That's my high. That's my high that you get when you're probably present at some of these beautiful births, that I can remember coming out and feeling like I'm on drugs. I get that same oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin rush from seeing a mum who's been empowered to feed her own baby. And all I've done is I've been able to be hands off and just talk her through and support her and guide her in a gentle manner. And that is amazing.
I was waiting for your goosebumps, because you get those every podcast.
I didn't get any. I got tears though. Your turn, Rachel. So I love this question because it just shows our diversity of our audience who are listening to this podcast. And so this is really brilliant. And the question was, what actually breaks, and is it really water? I love it. I think it's brilliant.
All right. So, see, there's the so again. So first of all, let's look at the words, because there's lots of controversy about the words. Some people don't like to use the word break or rupture because they think they're negative, and prefer to use the word release because it's kind of a releasing of the baby. It's got more positive connotations. I actually don't mind. I quite like break and rupture because I kind of like the drama in it, and it often is quite dramatic when women's waters break. So generally I go along with whatever the woman's calling it. But most women seem to talk about waters breaking because that's like the cultural norm, and that's certainly the word that's used. So what actually breaks is the amniotic sac, which is attached to the placenta. So you've got the placenta, which is actually part of an amniotic sac that the baby lives in. And it's that sac that's kind of breaks, and it either is eroded through something like prostaglandins, which is the hormones that happen around the cervix close to having the baby. Infection can also erode that membrane and release or break the membranes. But more commonly, it breaks because of pressure from the baby onto the four waters, which is the bag of waters. It's all one bag of waters, but it's like the baby's head sits on the front of it, and it's like four waters bulge forward in front of the baby's head. So that functions in pregnancy, in labor and birth, to help open the cervix. So the amniotic sac has a really important function in labor and birth, which we talked about in a previous podcast about the squidge. So usually the water will break at the end of labor. And that's why I quite like the word rupture or break, because it's at that point where the woman is unraveling. She's becoming broken. She's kind of in pieces at that transitional point. And then you get a poof, and she'll, you know, big dramatic gush of fluid will often come out, or she'll like sense a big pop. So I quite like the drama of it all. So that's what's breaking. And is it really water? Well, yep, it is water, but it's fluid, and it's made up of about 700 mils of baby's urine.
Mm-hmm. And I love it.
About 350 mils, this is per day, of baby's lung secretion. So the baby's secreting lung secretions and peeing into the bag that surrounds it. And the placenta kind of clears it out. It absorbs through the placenta and out, which is why we look at the fluid around the baby to get an idea of how well the baby is, because it tells us, is the baby peeing into the fluid? Is the placenta, you know, doing its job of clearing out the fluid as it's coming out? So it is fluid, but it's mostly pee.
And it swallows that. It swallows all of it.
And pees it out again.
Last trimester. Yeah. Basically, we start life by drinking our own piss and peeing it out every day. Every day for weeks. And then we think it's disgusting to drink pee. I mean, basically, we should probably be drinking pee. Maybe there's a thing.
Is that one of your recommendations, or does that come with a disclaimer?
Also, just so you know,
thanks.
I will stick to my cup of tea. It looks a bit like pee this morning, but it isn't. And I've just let you know, I've never drunk my own pee. I don't plan to in the future. I mean, I have drunk my own pee, but as a baby. But that's the only time. Only time. I've seen those survivalists.
Backpedal.
Right. Thank you. That was a great answer for that question. I think we should talk about, we've had a couple of questions that really up for both of us.
No, this is one of our favorite topics, least favorite. So we talk about this all the time and then go, oh no, we can't talk about that. So we're going to talk about it, Katie. Are you ready?
No. Okay, so yes, that was a bit cruel to leave you on that cliffhanger, but this was a long podcast and there was loads of questions. So we've made it a two-parter. You'll have to hold out till the next episode to find out what is the question that makes both of us go, ugh. So until next time, keep sharing, keep liking, and thank you for all of your support. And I'll leave you with the bloopers.
Looking at me like I've killed someone. This is what he's done all day. I don't know what I've done.
It's freaking
obviously something.
Which one? Plucky.
Plucky. It's because he wants feeding, and if you don't feed him, he just shames you all day, like makes you think you've killed
somebody.
How
long do you not feed him for?
He gets fed all the time. It's not, there's food in his bowl right now. There's food in his bowl, but his problem is you have to go and shake the bowl so that he eats it. And I'm not doing that. He can go and eat it without me shaking the bowl. And if he's going to shame me, he can sit and shame me.
Good. You tell him. That's working, obviously, because the fact that he does it most days.
Look, hang on. Let me show. Look, can you see him in the doorway?
Oh, just sitting, watching. When will you feed me? I'm so poorly.
Shake my bowl so I can eat the food.
Run the tap for me because I can't possibly drink still. Flat water. I'm a cat.
I'm over it. I need a song like your Tuntai song. Induction, induction, everybody gets induction.
Then they have Tuntai babies and we want to cut them. 'Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.